Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Over the past few weeks, we've seen a great number of short-term market movements reacting to recent news headlines. Today, Jurrien Timmer, Fidelity's Director of Global Macro, provides his Global Macro and Markets Update, recorded on October 5th, 2020. Jurrien and host Pamela Ritchie discuss how investors can look past these recent events and stay focused on the long term. Jurrien will take a closer look on the impact of the upcoming U.S. election on the markets and the likelihood of additional government stimulus. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Great to see you, Jurrien. Welcome.
Good morning, Pamela. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Good to see you. Jurrien, I wonder if we can begin. Let's begin with the stimulus discussion here. Are we more or less likely to see fiscal stimulus out of the United States, out of the White House, out of Congress, out of everyone agreeing to this in the Senate, or less likely pre-election?
It's a tough question because I think the willingness is probably there more than it was last week, you know, with the president falling ill. Maybe that provides a shot in the arm for Congress, for, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin to kind of hammer out a deal. I mean, they've been in talks every day last week, from what I understand, but that the numbers were too far apart. The Democrats won $2+ trillion. Used to be three plus trillion, and the White House wanted something less. So my sense is that the willingness is there, but now, of course, the Senate has been they've adjourned until I think the 19th, although they can come back within 24 hours notice to pass on a bill. But, you know, a number of Republican senators are now quarantined themselves. So it's unclear how the actual procedure would take place, but my sense is that the willingness is there, and the market needs it. You know, the economy needs it. Kind of that momentum of that liquidity impulse that we got from the first few phases of the CARES Act is waning, and so we need to renew that, because obviously the economy is not running at 100% yet.
Right. You know, on Friday, it almost was a passing discussion, the jobs number that many were waiting for to sort of give a sense. It seemed to not roil the markets particularly one way or the other. But what do you see sort of broadly for the jobs picture and perhaps related to the fiscal discussion as well?
Yeah, well, it's very related to that discussion. So the payroll number on Friday, it was kind of neither here nor there. I mean, the headline number was a little softer than was expected, but underneath it was an okay number and in line with what we've seen from the jobless claims data on a weekly basis. So, you know, you had a sudden crash as the economy locked down in March, and then a gradual recovery, which is pretty consistent with kind of the natural disaster analog that people will use. But I think a key thing of this next tranche of fiscal relief is that the PPP, the payroll protection plan that was instituted a number of months ago, if my understanding is correct, and I'm no expert on it, but my understanding is that on September 30th, which of course was last week, that, you know, companies that took stimulus checks, basically PPP checks, were not allowed to fire people until September 30th. So we're now past September 30th, and last week we saw a bunch of layoffs. The airlines were, you know, kind of threatening and then actually going through with tens of thousands of people getting laid off. So there is an urgency to get this next phase done so that, and Nancy Pelosi already said it last week to the airlines, say, come on, just hold on for a few days while we hammer this deal out, because that deal would then provide more relief in exchange for, again, people not getting laid off. So the risk is that if a deal is not passed, that in the coming weeks, we could see basically massive amounts of layoffs of people that were kept on the books before because of the PPP money. So I do think the stakes are high, and I think the market is very, very focused on this. And, you know, obviously the news on Friday about the president contracting COVID, is a market moving event, because markets do not like all this uncertainty. But I think ultimately it's really that fiscal piece that is what the market is most focused on. And of course, the sense now is that that Trump's reelection is in jeopardy because he has COVID. That's obviously a story, but the markets are up today, apparently because, the president is doing better. But I think there's more to that story than just that. But if you look at the betting odds on the president winning reelection, as well as the Senate holding on to the Republicans holding on to the Senate, those numbers have been very much in favor of a Democrat blue sweep or blue wave, as we call it. And those numbers really accelerated not on Friday, but on Tuesday after the presidential debate. So I think that debate actually was more of something that moved the needle. And so the markets basically are assuming a blue wave come November. And I think part of the reason why actually the markets are up this morning, in part because obviously the situation with the president is improving, but also in part because the numbers in favor of Biden and the Democrats taking the Senate are now so decisive, 10 plus points, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, that it starts to diminish the risk of a contested election, right? I mean, the assumption is that if the margin is big enough, we'll know the outcome right on election evening. And regardless of the direction of that outcome, the markets will like that, because the markets do not like to be kept in limbo. They want to be able to plan ahead for the future. So I think that's kind of the narrative that's really going on here in the markets.
Urien, so on that, and sort of just going a bit further along that discussion, there have been discussions. Denise Chisholm, your colleague, has brought some data to the fore showing that, for instance, tax increases don't always matter a ton, because often they come along with sort of a stimulus situation. Taxes is one of the big things that observers will watch, market observers will watch about a Biden presidency. Can you sort of bring that into more recent light?
I've sliced and diced the election results all the way back to the first election and what it means for the stock market, looking at the 2 years following the election for the stock market based on various different election outcomes. So Republican president, Democratic president, Republican sweep, Democrat sweep, some form of divided Congress, some form of gridlock. There's a pretty big difference in outcomes depending on what the election results are. Although over 4 years, those differences pretty much all fall away, because over the long term, the economy is bigger than politics. And also we have midterm elections every 2 years, which can kind of course correct a very one-sided outcome. But it's unmistakable that a Democrat sweep or a blue wave, as we're calling it, historically has yielded significantly poorer results than a Republican sweep. And my guess is, the understanding I think in the market is that the reason for this is that Democrats historically like to regulate more, and they tend to have higher taxes than Republicans. I know that's really a simplification, and don't hold me to that. But I think that's generally the perception in the market. So at first glance, a blue wave in November, which now seems more likely, would be a negative. But as you pointed out, and as Denise has mentioned, you can see that it is by no means a binary, relationship between taxes and the markets. The markets can go up while taxes go up. The markets can go down while taxes go down. So the tax rates are really only one component of what drives the markets. And obviously, if taxes are going up, while there's a tremendous amount of fiscal stimulus, which presumably in a blue wave would be the case, right? There would be multiple trillions of dollars of infrastructure and green, environmental policy, and that will be paid for at least in part by higher taxes on corporations and wealthy Americans. But so you need to kind of combine all of those different things. And so it's not a foregone conclusion that higher taxes would be a death knell for the stock market or for investors. And certainly that's true on corporate taxes. If they go from 21 to 28%, which is what the Biden proposal has, I don't want to just immediately conclude that that's going to create a bear market, because history does not really suggest that. I do think that one element of this, there's some talk that the capital gains tax, which is now, I think, 20%, would be almost double, well, actually would be almost doubled to match the income, the personal income tax. If that happens, that's not necessarily negative for the market itself, but that could cause some tax harvesting even this year, because if you remember the last time taxes went up, they went up retroactively. That was during the Obama years, I think. And so people are not going to wait around until, February or March or April to say, if I have big gains in my tech stocks, I'm going to sell them now. So I think we're actually seeing this already a little bit in the markets, that the FANGs, which I've been correcting for the last few weeks, maybe there's some tax harvesting going on there, because people might expect any tax increases next year to be retroactive to the beginning of next year, which means they'd have to sell today. So maybe this is part of a rotation from growth to value. That's right. That's already kind of the thinking, right? If you have a Biden administration with the Senate controlled by the Democrats, and you've got, let's say, $7 trillion of deficit spending on all kinds of things, that should in theory boost the money supply, especially if that policy is absorbed by the Fed, just like the Fed did in the 1940s, and we've talked about that many times. Then you should see a boost in the money supply, which would increase inflation and which would lead to a rotation from growth to value, especially if the FANG stocks, the tech sector, gets more scrutiny on the regulatory front by the Democrats. So I think there's a lot going on, but it's sort of below the surface and not like, taxes up, stocks down. That's too simplistic, I think, a way to look at it.
Yeah, all of those things in there, that just further discussion of regulation and what that might look like. It's hard to know what that might look like, but just the sort of whisper of it. So one of the things that you also have been bringing to our attention for some time now is this discussion between inflation and deflation. And there are a number of questions coming in right now. So one is it possible for interest rates to stay very low even if there is inflation? And the other question, related, with all this stimulus, how do you see future debt repayments and other things that overhang and drag on the economy? So again, which do you lean any differently? Take us through this. There's interest today. Yeah.
So my favorite playbook historically for this exact scenario is World War II, the 1940s. And we've talked about this many times, but during the 40s, the Fed was not yet independent. That happened in 1951. And so one of the Fed's jobs was to monetize wartime debt. So, of course, we know the story from 1941, 42 to 46. Debt to GDP ramped up massively. It went from 35% of GDP to 116%. And the Fed essentially absorbed that debt by increasing its balance sheet tenfold. Now, the balance sheet was much smaller than it is now, both in absolute terms and as a percentage of GDP. But still, a tenfold increase is something. And it not only increased its balance sheet, it also anchored interest rates at very, very low levels. So the policy rate, the discount rate back then, which would now be the Fed funds rate, was kept at around 1% throughout the entire period, even though inflation was spiking up into the double digits. And the Fed capped short rates at 0.375% and capped long rates at 2.5%. So when you have very low anchored interest rates and rising inflation, of course, real rates go down and they become negative. And so when you have a large debt burden, negative rates is one way to kind of get out of, you know, debt jail, basically. And my sense is, and again, this is just my own interpretation of events, is that the Fed would very much like to do a repeat of this if it turns out that the deficit will keep growing and the debt levels will keep going up. You know, already this year, the fiscal relief has been about 20% of GDP. So the numbers are really staggering. And the CBO just came out with projections. So the debt to GDP right now is about 125% or so. And the CBO projections are that over the next decade or so, it'll go up to 200% of GDP. So huge numbers. And obviously, if you can grow out of that debt, right? If there is some massive stimulus coming out of the Democrats or the Republicans, for that matter, and it somehow boosts productivity or it's, you know, creates a shot in the arm for the economy, then you can grow out of that debt. But if you can't, you need negative real rates. So I think the Fed, I think that's the playbook to use: higher debt levels, big expansion in the balance sheet from the Fed, and anchored low rates, allowing real rates to come down. But for that to happen, you actually need to have inflation, of course, because if you don't have inflation, then low real rates will do nothing, because you could even have a rise in real rates if inflation goes down. So the link between that policy framework and inflation, I can see it, right? And especially if the money supply growth goes up, if M2 growth goes north, as it is doing right now, historically, there's been a good correlation between that and inflation. And when inflation goes up, there's a really good correlation for the long cycle in terms of rotation from growth to value and from financial assets to real assets. And this is one of the reasons, of course, gold has done so well.
And real estate, pockets of real estate, not all real estate, but some parts of the housing market, for sure. The moment sort of within the inflation discussion, deflation discussion, if you ask about the health of the consumer through this fall, I mean, from your perspective, it looks like second waves are indeed going on. How does the consumer react further to that? There's also this question, as you mentioned, of job losses. Do we see tightening? How do you look at the health of the consumer through the fall with a second wave, if you want to call it that, or the threat?
I mean, that's a really important question. And again, it all comes down to the fiscal side, right? So if we get another wave, and we seem to be going through one, certainly Europe is, and even in the US, there's pockets of it. And I know in Canada, there is as well. The question is, will that wave and potential further lockdowns or restrictions on activity, will that be offset by more fiscal relief? And I think the thinking is that it will, and I think that's what the market is expecting. And if it is, then we'll just see a continuation of what we've seen over the past 6 months, which is that people's purchasing power is pretty strong because they don't have a lot of places to spend other than online, but they're getting the transfer payments. And so the savings rate's gone through the roof. And so the purchasing power, the spending power is there. It's just a question of, will people actually be able to go out and spend it, and how will they spend it? Will they travel and go on vacation, or will it be more, you know, goods, or will it be, you know, day trading stocks? I mean, so that's kind of, I think, the bigger question, but it all hinges to, will we get kind of phase four of the CARES Act, as we would call it here in the US? And also this wave of COVID cases, you know, how deadly is that wave? So far, it has proven to not be nearly as deadly at all. As I was saying to you before the show, you know, my nurse is my daughter is an ICU nurse, 1 year out of school in one of the big Boston hospitals. And I was talking to her yesterday, and I was asking, you know, the case count is going up in Boston. It was about 200 cases a day. Now it's 600. But she's not really seeing more traffic in the ICU because she says it's all the college students, and they don't, you know, they don't even go really to the hospitals, let alone die. And so there is some question as to, you know, whether, to what degree this will overwhelm or not overwhelm the healthcare system. And if it doesn't overwhelm it, then that should allow governments and states and countries not to impose as many restrictions as we did back in March, when obviously the first wave was very, very deadly.
Right, right. Yeah, there's so many interesting, I mean, just sort of on the healthcare, perhaps biotech, the healthcare side of things. You talk about sectors, I think, and you have a slide sort of looking at some of them, but how do you see this going forward? I mean, we've actually seen some mergers today, Bristol Myers buying up a cancer drug maker. I mean, there's a lot of movement in the biotech space right now. How do you look at it?
So, yeah, this market remains highly bifurcated, as it has been since February, on the way down and then on the way up. So the winners, that we all know who the winners are, of course, it's the FANGs, large cap, growth, tech, healthcare, you know, pharma, biotech, and some of the consumer names who do online well. Of course, Amazon is the big behemoth there, but there are others as well. And those have been in the lead. And then, you know, energy, the banks, small caps, value, have been sort of left behind. And, you know, and one of the things that gives me pause about the inflation narrative that we just discussed, you know, you look at the TIPS break evens, you look at gold, they suggest at least asset price inflation and maybe real inflation coming down the line. And again, that's an easy, those are easy dots to connect given what we're seeing in money supply growth and maybe a much more expansionary fiscal policy. But someone hasn't told the value side of the market about that, because you see that the bottom part, that spread keeps getting wider and wider. And so I think I'm not one, for one, do not want to bet against this growth story, the big growers, including the biotechs and healthcare in general and tech. But, you know, if tech get, so I think tech is more regulation prone, perhaps, under a blue sweep than some of the healthcare. I mean, healthcare is generally a regulated industry, so there is some concern about regulation in healthcare, but that's more, that has less to do with biotech and more to do with, I think, managed care and you know, kind of a universal healthcare type of scenario. Although that certainly does not seem to be part of the Biden plan, you know, like a single payer universal healthcare. So I still believe in those names, but I do think we might see some tax harvesting in the near term for everything that's done really, really well. But that doesn't mean that the long-term leadership cannot stay in place.
Thank you, Jurjen, for joining us today and giving us so many things to think about and taking us out of the headlines too, and giving it perspective.
Yes. Thank you very much, Pamela. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.